Chapter 3. Terra, the Imperial Palace. Robed, Abathar gazed at the armor he was about to don once more and thought of the task ahead. He was standing on the precipice of meaning. He needed to understand the nature of his leap, and his armor was the key to that understanding. He knew this at a deep level, one without words, one at the same depths as that which resonated with the needs of the machine spirits when he listened to their rages and pains. Outside the Tech Marine's armorium, footsteps rang up and down the corridors of the Imperial Palace barracks reserved for the Dark Angels. He heard the careful tread of chapter serfs. He heard the mechanical trudge of servitors. He heard the metallic cacophony of repairs, the murmur of prayers, and the whisper of oaths. Shadows, flickering in torchlight, moved over the armor and its folded servo arms. The restless dark was deep, rich with imminent knowledge. The revelation was approaching. The sound of the mobilization seemed hollow and sparse. So many empty armoria and meditation cells, so many brothers lost. It would be easy to hear in the diminishment the echo of defeat. After a loss, a smaller muster, a weakened force. That would be a lie, he thought. It was true the combined chapters on Terra could not attack the orcs as they had before. It was true the new strategy Corland had proposed was the product of necessity. Not the full truths, the Tech Marine muttered. Lord? One of his armament serfs asked. They were standing by, waiting for him to permit them to return to their work of repair. His armor had escaped critical damage on Olenor, but it had been badly scorched by vehicle-mounted flamers. It was blackened across most of its surface. The livery of the Dark Angels awaited restoration. Wait, Abathar said. The full truth was that Corlin's plan would be a small deployment, even if the disaster of Olenor had never occurred. The plan had come into being through necessity, but its shape surpassed necessity. It was a new thing. In the demands it placed on the members of the kill teams, it was an extraordinary thing. Abathar thought about the Space Marines at whose side he would be fighting. An Ultramarine? A Blood Angel? A Space Wolf? The composition of the teams was astounding. It would never have been possible before Olenor. Here again was a product of necessity, and again the form of the act surpassed what was forced and entered into the realm of true daring and unprecedented innovation. Small squads of uniform composition would have been understandable. There were enough survivors of each chapter to have mounted operations on that scale, but Corland was urging them all to go further. The orders were to forge squad-level bonds with Space Marines who were strangers to him and to the ways of his brothers. At least one he would have regarded with so much suspicion he would have refused to be in the same room as that warrior in other circumstances. The circumstances were beyond extraordinary. So was Corin's plan. He is asking us to become something new, Abathar said. The squads were born of death, and their mission was death. They would be a lethal blade, beaten to a point in the forge of tragedy. Abathar watched the shadows on his armor, darkness shifting over black. The shadows appeared to him to be the shadows of his lost brothers. The dead of Ulanor called to Abathar and to all the Adeptus Astartes making ready to wage war in a new way. Look upon us, said the dead, witness us, and strike in our name. See our death, and stand guard in our stead. See our death, and visit it upon our enemies. Born of shadow, Abathar thought, we become shadow. We are the eye of death. He knew what he must do. Begin, he said to the serfs, but the armor needs new colors. The man and woman looked at each other, then at Abathar, confusion spreading over their features. Restore the right pauldron, Abathar said. It must remain as it was, the icon of the Dark Angels, pristine, the pride of brotherhood and chapter still announced to the universe. Paint the rest black.
Lord,
the woman said again,
you heard me.
It had been over 1,000 years since a dark angel had worn black livery. This darkness would be different, Abathar thought. It was the black of mourning, the black of anger, the black of the death witnessed and delivered. Corland found the Fabricator General in the laboratorium of the Cathedral of the Savior Emperor. Kubik was examining Magnaric's data feed again. When he saw Corland approaching, he gestured to the three tech priests attending him. They bowed and withdrew through doors at the far end of the chamber, angular limbs pistoning under their robes as they left. Kubik turned off the feed as Corland approached.
"What do you wish, Lord Commander?" he asked.
"I want to talk to you about the Orc teleportation technology. I want us to use it against the attack moon."
"That will not be possible," said Kubik.
"Because it won't work?"
"The Adeptus Mechanicus is not the Departmentum Munitorum, Lord Commander."
The voice was flat, mechanical, inhuman, and still it was contemptuous.
"Are we to rehearse our grievances once more?" Corland asked. "I had hoped we had put them in the past for the sake of the Imperium. You did not deny us the use of the gravity weapons on Caldera."
"That technology was deployed by the Adepts of the Mechanicus in that conflict. I heard no mention of their presence in your proposal."
"Nor did I make one."
"Then we have no more to say."
"I'm surprised, Fabricator General. The teleportation of a body as large as the attack moon holds no interest for you, then?"
Kubik's stillness was the closest thing to uncertainty Corland had ever detected in the High Lord.
"You are not planning to use the technology as an augmentation of our current teleportation capabilities?"
"No, not primarily. We are going to teleport the moon out of this system."
Kubik hesitated. It frustrated Corland that he could not tell if the Fabricator General was evaluating the feasibility of the plan or formulating a lie.
"The possibility of success is minimal," Kubik said at last.
But he seemed less resistant now. He was being captured by the challenge of the problem.
"Why?" "Our understanding of the technology is imperfect. Our adaptation is partial. The teleportation of Phobos was limited to repositioning it within its established orbit. The energy expenditure was of a magnitude very rare in a single action, requiring considerable resources on Mars. You wish to move a much larger body, a much greater distance. We cannot transport the energy sources of Mars to the attack moon."
There was a squeal of binary.
"I amend my estimation. The operation is impossible." "We used the Orcs' energy sources against them on Caldera. We tapped into their grid to power the gravity weapon. We will do that again, now."
Kubik straightened in interest and surprise.
"Employ the attack moon's power to generate its own teleportation?"
"Precisely."
Corland was aware of Kubik's optics, examining him closely.
"The proposal is intriguing," said Kubik. "It has the merit of providing a testing ground for our advances."
"It isn't a proposal," Corland said. "It's an order."
Kubik regarded him in silence, except for the low hum of servo motors and calibrating sensors.
"This is what must be done," said Corland. "We will neutralize the Orc base once and for all. The Council has been too generous with regards to the desires of the Mechanicus. You had your chance to study it. Now here we are, with the Orcs on our doorstep once more and the Navy falling before them. You have no more choice in obeying this order than I have in issuing it."
Kubik's digits flexed and curled, flexed and curled. He said nothing. He was still silent when Corland left, but he had not refused again. The initial muster for the kill teams was held in the monitors. Abathar had no difficulty in understanding the choice. The hall, with its statues of all the loyalist legions, represented the ultimate unity of the Adeptus Astartes. He saw meaning in its position so high above the great chamber. It was here, too, that Vulcan had shamed the High Lords. It was a fitting place for the beginning of the new venture, and of a very particular kind of unity, one he had heard tell that the High Lords feared. He arrived alone, following the orders of Grandmaster Sakael.
"You are Dark Angels," Sakael had told the survivors assigned to the kill teams. "But for the length of this mission, you will also be something else. You will fight with warriors you might have regarded as strangers in any other situation. You cannot do so now. You will join them as brothers. So you must arrive at the Monitus alone. In this manner, you are not departing a squad or a company. You are joining something else."
Abathar reached the top of the Stilicho Tower and entered the Monitus. He slowed as he approached his assigned position towards the center of the balcony. He was not the first to arrive. A figure was standing at the rail next to the ultramarine statue, looking down at the roofs of the Imperial Palace. The right pauldron showed the icon of the Space Wolves. But the armor was black. Abathar stopped 3 paces away. The Space Wolf heard him and turned around. Abathar faced the weathered, bearded features of Asgur Warfist. The Wolf Lord blinked in surprise. Neither Space Marine spoke. They acknowledged the importance of the moment with a solemn silence. Then Abathar said,
"This is not chance."
Warfist nodded slowly.
"It is fate."
When Abathar had entered the Monitus, there had been the low, echoing murmur of conversation. Now the sound was fading. Abathar saw Warfist's eyes shift, looking past him to the rest of the hall. They widened. Abathar turned. There were more warriors in black armor. Abathar counted 4 others. Not many, but enough to be significant, enough to prove the truth of Warfist's words. Fate was at work here. Its hand was visible to every warrior in the Monitus. All conversation ceased. The only sound was the rap of boots against marble as the Space Marines in black moved to their positions. They were the focus of attention in the hall. Abathar felt the force of 12 gazes fall on him. He was not troubled by the scrutiny, for he was as astonished as everyone else. He stared as hard as any of the others. A 7th warrior in black arrived, this one a Blood Angel, then an 8th, an ultramarine. Time in the Monitus paused, the hall filled with the power of significance. Warfist stepped forward. He moved to the center of the hall. He spoke, the wind-cured rasp of his voice stretching across the Monitus.
"Bear witness, brothers," he called. "Mark what is happening. This is a day the Imperium will remember."
He was 1 Space Marine among many, yet in declaring the importance of what was happening, he became its nexus. All eyes turned to Warfist. All voices spoke to him.
"An omen," said another Space Wolf on the other side of the hall. "It is more than that," Warfist said.
"We have done this," said Abathar. "It is not visited upon us. We have taken this action. We have made this choice."
"And the choice has weight beyond the acts of a single brother," Warfist continued. "One choice multiplied. This is a truth."
"So it is," said a Blood Angel nearby.
Abathar recognized him as Forkas. He had seen the name on the list of members of his designated kill team. Forkas's armor was still red.
"Can any of us doubt this truth when it appears to us so clearly and with such force?"
"Was this truly a choice, then?" Abathar wondered. "We were guided by the same circumstances, impulses, and realities."
"Perhaps we have made our own omen, then," said Warfist. "If we have, its weight is all the greater."
Forkas was nodding.
"I will do as you have done," he said.
"As will I,"
the other Space Wolf shouted. The call was taken up. The Monitors rang with the oaths of a grim unity. The individual squads came together. The assembled Space Marines formed an arc before Warfist and the great statues. Abathar observed his fellow warriors with growing awe as the moments succeeded each other with ever greater import. There was never doubt as to the ultimate unity of purpose of all the chapters of the Adeptus Astartes. Every battle brother, no matter how estranged he might be from those in another chapter, stood for the defense of the Emperor. On Ulanor, there had been the forging of many forces into one devoted to a single immediate goal. Here, though, was something else again. Here, the unity was not institutional. It was being forged at the level of the individual. There would be friction between members of the kill teams. Abathur had no illusions about himself or how he would feel, fighting in the same squad as a space wolf. And yet, what is this thing we are becoming? Born of death, forged in death, living memoria of lost brothers, returning in anger.
What are we?
Warfist roared. The question demanded an answer, but it was shouted with a certainty of the inevitability of that answer.
We are witness, said Forcas,
and Abathur heard his thoughts present and past being spoken by others. Here now we are one, he thought. We are this new weapon.
We watch from death, said the ultramarine in black. We are vigilance. We are vengeance. We are the judgment. Come for the Xenos Challenger.
There was such clamor in his mind, in his soul, and in the hall, that Abathur could not tell if the words came from within or without. Perhaps they were both. Internal need had led to an external manifestation on his armor and on that of other battle brothers. They were the example. They were the clarity of black. Space Wolf, Dark Angel, Blood Angel, and Ultramarine had spoken with a single voice.
We are the Death Watch!
The words rang out above the others, given strength by their iron truth. It was a moment before Abathur realized the voice was his.
Death Watch, Warfist repeated.
Death Watch, said Forcas.
Death Watch, the word, the name, the truth, was shouted by every warrior in the Monitus. It was the moment of creation. That which had been shattered on Ulanor had taken on a new shape, renewed of purpose. Death Watch, it was a blade aimed at the throat of the beast. The clouds parted. The attack moon appeared as if in anger at the challenge. The roars grew louder.
Death Watch!
Abathur shouted the name, and it was a mission. It was a calling. It was an identity. Sakiel had been correct. Abathur was a dark angel. Nothing would change that. Nothing could. But he was also this new thing. As his armor bore the colors of two allegiances, so did his being. There was no contradiction. The Death Watch was formed of disparate pieces, and it would depend on their separate identities to create its own. What have we become? The full answer would come in time, but the name was here, defined by the crucible of sacrifice and vengeance. The one and the many had become synonymous. Death Watch. The refrain was a thunder strong far beyond sound. It shook the Stilicho Tower. It cracked the air over the Imperial Palace. It rose to the sky, towards the attack moon. It was an answer to the endless shout.
I am Slaughter,
the beast exulted, and the warriors of many chapters said,
Fear us.
You want me to go back?
Galatea Haas said.
Yes, Corlin said.
They were in the barracks of the Adeptus Arbites. Despite her rise in rank, Haas spent most of her time in this quadrant. Her authority now extended to most of the arbitrators still in the continent-sized palace. She was proctor of the Primus Imperialis division, and she looked exhausted. The numbers of the Adeptus Arbites had been so badly cut by the Proletarian Crusade that their efficiency was a shadow of what it had been. Haas's office reflected the constraints under which she labored. It was bare except for a battered desk, a wooden chair, an equipment footlocker, and a massive vox array. Corlin found himself comparing the officer before him to the Grand Provost Marshal in the Great Chamber. He did not doubt Zek's skill. His ability to process vast amounts of data was more than impressive, and he had a keen strategic mind. It was the uses to which Zek's skill was put that inspired Corlin's contempt. Had Zek ever been something more than the political animal he was now? Corlin had his doubts. To become a High Lord, Zek would have had to concentrate first and foremost on the goals of his ambition. His effectiveness as an administrator would have been a byproduct of his personal desires. In Haas, Corlin saw a career take the form of a calling. He recognized her driven gaze. It was a product of duty and of loss. She greeted the news that she was being asked to return to the attack moon with a grim, tight-lipped calm, as if she had been expecting this conversation. She did not ask if she had a choice. She said,
"You're going inside again?"
"Yes, deeper. Small teams. This will be an infiltration."
"I see. What is my role?"
"We will be looking for control centers and power sources. You are more familiar with the interior than anyone else still living."
"I understand."
She tapped her shock maul where it hung from her belt. She took a breath.
"I shall be ready to embark when you command."
"Thank you, Proctor. It would have been understandable if you'd been reluctant."
Understandable, though reluctance would not have kept her on Terra. She was needed, and Corland had been prepared to order her participation in the mission. Presenting her with a request first had been a courtesy and a mark of his respect for what she had survived and what she had accomplished. He was pleased the request had been enough.
"Reluctant?" Haas said. "May I speak freely, Lord Commander?"
"Please do."
"The prospect of returning there fills me with horror."
She spoke calmly, her voice and her gaze steady. There was a faint twitch in her right eye. It was the only expression of what she was really feeling.
"But I joined the Proletarian Crusade for a reason. I had a task, and that task is incomplete."
"Your commitment to duty is admirable."
Her mouth twisted.
"I'm not a saint," she said. "I lost my friends. I saw..."
She faltered. The twitch became more pronounced.
"When the mountains moved..."
She looked past Corland at something colossal. He knew what she was remembering. Billions of civilians and troops crushed, turned into a towering wave of blood. He knew what had happened on the surface of the moon. He had not witnessed it, though he had seen other horrors on Adamantua. He could empathize without being able to experience the precise nightmare. They had each gathered their individual scars.
"You want revenge," Corland said.
Her gaze sharpened again. She gave him a curt nod.
"I want to see the Greenskins die in the same numbers, and I want to be responsible for that."
"You will be," Corland promised.
The embarkation of the kill teams took place in the Inner Palace's pocket spaceport. There were three squads heading for the attack moon. Each was to board a Thunderhawk bound for the Dark Angel strike cruiser Herald of Night, which waited at low anchor to take them through the war zone. The ship was the fastest of the Adeptus Astartes vessels present over Terra. Vangorich watched the departure from the far western edge of the landing pad. The hot wind from the first of the Thunderhawk's turbofan engines blew his hair back. His eyes were painfully dry. Beside him, Venand raised a hand to shield her eyes from the glare as a gunship turned on descent, its engines bright as suns in the pre-dawn gloom.
"They're all in black,"
Venand said, looking at the 13 space marines.
"I've heard the change started with a few, and the others followed suit."
"You have thoughts?"
"Corland's force already has a distinct identity. Before the first battle."
"A good sign, wouldn't you say?"
"For the task ahead, definitely."
Venand cocked her head.
"Interesting hedge. Wasn't this your idea in the first place?"
"It was," he conceded.
The Thunderhawk's embarkation ramp lowered. Corland crossed the landing, coming from an eastern entrance to the spaceport. He stopped in front of the gunship and faced the kill teams. Thane was with him. Their armor was not black.
"Here's a difference," Venand said.
"Understandable," said Vangorich. "The continued existence of the Imperial Fists hangs by a thread. I can't imagine Corland would do anything to downplay the memory of the chapter."
The Imperial Fists' livery was already the color of mourning, he thought.
"Brothers,"
Corland said, his voice amplified by voxcasters around the periphery of the landing pad.
"You have earned my thanks many times over during the course of this war. You have fought, you have sacrificed, and you have followed me. What I see before me is something for which I cannot in good conscience express gratitude. To do so would be the height of arrogance. You have found the true meaning of our actions on this day. The last wall rose from ashes. So
has the Death Watch?
It has a name, Vangrich said to Venand. I've heard it more than once now. I didn't anticipate that when I spoke to Courland. I didn't expect the identity to form so quickly, or so definitively.
That's a problem?
The differences between a conception and its execution can be a source of unease.
I can't believe you're backing down from your position in the Council. You fought hard for this operation.
I know, said Vangrich, and I still believe in it. This is our best hope now.
I'm still hearing but in your voice.
We are many, and we are one, Courland was saying. Today we will strike the Greenskins in a manner they cannot anticipate, and in a manner that already surpasses anything I might have hoped.
The roar of the assembled Death Watch forced Vangrich to wait before responding. When the noise subsided, Venand spoke first.
Surpassing hope isn't necessarily a good thing, is it?
She said. He managed a tight, grim smile.
Do you think it's entirely healthy for you to know me that well?
For you or for me?
Either, he thought. He shrugged.
The name. The colours, he said. The black. I wasn't expecting any of that. So coherent an identity so soon.
The other High Lords anticipated this, or something very similar.
True. That doesn't mean they were right about this force's long-term significance.
He became aware that Venand was looking at him sharply.
Altering livery isn't something the Adeptus Astartes do lightly, she said.
No, it may be a necessary gesture for this attempt to succeed.
Venand snorted.
You don't believe that's all it is?
No, I don't.
We're witnessing the start of something that is going to be with us for a long time, Venand said. That's what is bothering you, isn't it?
It is, said Vangrich.
You don't really believe Courland is planning a coup, though, do you?
I don't. Vangrich sighed. It's not what he intends that's the problem. It's the thing he has created. The more successful the Death Watch is, the more difficult it will be to disband. And thrown, we need it to be successful. But afterwards, what then?
You just implied you trusted Courland.
If he doesn't survive, said Vangrich, if his successor sees more potential for the Death Watch than the immediate crisis...
Pessimist,
Venand said.
Pessimism is my duty, said Vangrich.
He looked at her.
You don't seem worried.
I think you've been in the presence of other High Lords for too long, Draken. They're a bad influence. Their thinking is constricting yours.
What do you mean?
I'm more intrigued by the possibilities than the dangers.
You think the Council's anxieties are groundless?
I didn't say that. If we consider them in the right light, they may, in fact, be the key to the possibilities.
Which are?
I'm not sure yet.
Courland had finished speaking, and the first of the kill teams had followed him into the Thunderhawk. It lifted off, and a second gunship descended to take on Thane and the next squad.
I think we need to see how this plays out first, Venand said. Don't you agree?
I do, said Vangrich.
She was right, and he did still believe in the effort underway. There were no other options left. Courland had listened to his advice and had adapted the philosophy of the Officio Assassinorum to the crisis and to the Adeptus Astartes. He had forged his blade.
We are directing the primary data feeds to your vox frequency,
Adnakiel told Courland.
I am receiving them. Thank you, Company Master. I wish I could be on the bridge with you.
You are where you need to be,
Adnakiel said. Inside a Thunderhawk, inside a landing bay, he thought. He respected Courland. He accepted his authority as Lord Commander. For the combined efforts of the chapters to maintain cohesion, centralized command was needed. Between the traditional calling of the Imperial Fists as the defenders of the Terran Wall, and Courland's status as both a unifier of successors and a warrior without a chapter, he was the logical, least objectionable choice for that position. Adnakiel also accepted the reasons for the Death Watch. He supported the action. He expected the battle brothers he had seconded to the kill teams to commit fully to the effort and to the cooperation with warriors from other chapters, no matter what chapters they might be. He accepted all the necessities of the struggle against the beast. Even so, He preferred Corlan to be in a position where Adnachiel had some control over the information he received. The Herald of Night was the necessary ship to make the run to the attack moon. It was not necessary that there be any presence on its bridge that was not a Dark Angel. There were no visual feeds to the Thunderhawk, but Adnachiel ensured Corlan had a channel to the command vox and received a constant update of ship positions relative to the Herald. He would know the state of the battle, he would know when the moment came for the launches. The strike cruiser cut through the void, closing in on the burning region of the attack moon.
"The Imperial Navy still has the orcs contained,"
Shipmaster Aelia said. Adnachiel grunted.
"They're holding them only because this is the greatest concentration of ships to destroy," he said.
The tacticarium screens flickered as they adjusted to the constant changes. The positions of Navy vessels changed slowly compared to the darting swarm of orc ships. Their status changed far more quickly. Green icons flashed amber, then red, then vanished. The frigates and destroyers that made up the blockade fleet were far from being the largest of the Navy's command. Each was still over a kilometer long, with crews numbering in the tens of thousands. The pace at which they were disappearing from the sight of the Herald's Auspex array was disturbing. The orcs were feasting on the Terran fleet. There were still 15 destroyers, almost as many frigates, and scores of escorts still in the fighting. Nowhere near enough. Adnachiel had to hope they would feast a little longer. He resented the necessity for that hope. His anger spurred his determination to see the moon destroyed. He looked back and forth between the screen readouts and the cloud of battle visible in the oculus. A battle cluster was forming, growing tighter. The Imperial ships were converging as they sought to provide supporting fire for each other. The orcs battened on the higher concentration of prey. The blockade still surrounded the moon, but as the Navy fell, gaps opened. The orcs were not coming through them yet. They appeared to be intent on the total annihilation of the blockade.
"Commander, we have a possible course plotted," Aelia said.
"Show me,"
Adnachiel said. The mortal pressed a key on her command throne stationed just above Adnachiel's pulpit. An arcing path appeared on the oculus, cutting through one of the gaps to bring the Herald of Night close to the surface of the orc base.
"No,"
Adnachiel said. "The target is the interior." The nearest approach of Aelia's route would force the kill teams to breach a surface thick enough to be a planetary crust or travel to the open maw. That would take too long, giving the orcs too much time to detect and counter the attack.
"The jaws are our goal."
Orc interceptors still streamed from the vast launch bay. The grotesque mouth opened and closed in an imitation of speech. It was the beast's shout, given visual form. It gaped wide, narrowed, then gaped again. It never shut completely.
"Use the gap between the vessels," Adnachiel said. "Enter the battle by that path, then cut through to the moor. Maximum speed, continuous fire."
"So ordered," said Aelia.
The Herald of Night plunged towards the war. It was larger and more powerful than any ship still in the battle, and its approach altered the gravitational tides of conflict. Adnachiel tracked the readings and the oculus display. In his mind's eye, he saw the full shape of the struggle. He saw the shifting currents, the networks of the fire, the ripple effects of actions, large and small. The cloud began to bulge towards the Herald. The movement was slow. The orcs were becoming aware of what was closing in, but they were already engaged. The reinforcements coming from the moon turned in the direction of the strike cruiser. Some were destroyed by crossfire within moments of their emergence. Others became caught in the maelstrom of the war. Still others kept their heading.
"The enemy has seen us," Aelia said.
"And I see them," Adnachiel answered. "Maintain course. We will meet them and crush them."
The strike cruiser entered the gap. To port and starboard, above and below the course of the ship, the void burned and screamed. The edges of the oculus flashed with lance and torpedo fire. Ignited plasma billowed towards the center of Adnachiel's vision. In the upper right of his view, a dozen orc interceptors dived towards the core of the destroyer, unstinting. Its void shields fell. Its hull, already compromised, erupted. A new star burst from the center. Destroyer and interceptors vanished in its roiling embrace. Edging in from the left was an intersecting web of fire between two frigates as they struggled to cut down the horde of greenskin ships that circled them like feasting insects. The gap between the battles had looked like empty void from a distance. Now it revealed itself to be a graveyard of broken hulks and dying gas flares. It was dense with ruin. The Herald of Night struck the corpses of ships with its prow. A huge tomb of ragged metal, half a kilometer long, tumbled end over end along the Herald's length towards the superstructure. The void shield strained under the impacts, but held. Adnakiel saw the ruin fill the oculus, then vanish as the feed redirected to sensors on the other side of the obstacle. The hulk slammed against the superstructure. The impact reverberated through the hull. Adnakiel felt it in the walls of the bridge and in the deck. The Herald of Night was moving fast, and the mass of the hulk was huge. It strained the void shields to their limit. The first red icons of damage reports appeared on the Tacticarium screens.
"Anomalous gravity readings,"
Aelia announced. At the same moment, strange waves swept through the ship. Adnakiel felt himself weighed down, then pulled upward, as if he might fly to the dome of the bridge. Conflicting forces pressed against him. His lyman's ear resisted the disorientation, but still his sense of the vertical fragmented. It spun. He held steady. Below, officers and serfs lost their balance. Some fell from their seats. Servitors jerked upwards and then down against banks of consoles. The hull groaned. Adnakiel saw new meaning in the shape of the path. The orc's gravity weapon had swept through these coordinates, a scythe for ships. The reports reaching Terra from the battle had indicated it was active, but in a limited fashion. Its area of effect was narrow. Its strikes were sporadic. The orcs were back. But the injury they inflicted before was real, Adnakiel thought. The base was weaker. The Herald of Night's run was a wager. There was no pretending otherwise. But if the aftershocks of the weapon were still being felt, it had been used very recently. Adnakiel disliked wagers. War had too much chance in it already. To willingly engage with it was a form of moral carelessness. His hand was forced, though, and everything about the Death Watch mission was a wager. But the fading gravity effects were promising. If he must wager, perhaps he was making a good one. The Herald of Night ploughed onward through the debris field, speed undiminished. Ahead, Adnakiel saw a path to the curve of the attack moon's surface.
"Hard to port," he ordered. "Fire at will."
"Hard to port,"
Aelia confirmed. The Herald's bow turned from the darkened path towards the cloud of lethal light. Its batteries acquired targets and fired. The first orc interceptors came into range and died. The hull shook as the ship entered a zone of overlapping shockwaves. Hostile targets closed in.
"Master of the Vox," Adnakiel called. "Begin a broadcast to all Imperial vessels."
"Transmitting,"
Master of the Vox Enger confirmed.
"Ships of the Imperial Navy," Adnakiel said. "We come to drive a blade through the heart of the Greenskins. Hold the Xenos. Do not allow them to deflect the blow."
He paused.
"End Voxcast," he told Enger.
Now the surviving officers of the blockade knew their situation. The Herald of Night had not come to reinforce them. Instead, their role was to support its mission. If any still lived at the end of this day, they would receive the gratitude of the Imperium for their service. The view in the oculus shifted, reflecting the changes to the Herald of Night's course. The orb of the attack moon moved to the center. It was partially obscured by the explosions of ships and the pinprick flashes of guns. Its maw snarled, hate made of stone and iron. The base grew larger.
"How close?" Aelia began.
"As close as we're able," Adnakiel said.
He shifted his stance in the pulpit, bracing for the inevitable lash of the gravity weapon, balancing risks, riding the lethal edge of the wager. If the Herald of Night took the full force of what the orcs were capable of, the mission would end before it had begun. But he had to get the Death Watch into proximity with the target.
"Get us in a direct line with the jaws," Adnakiel said.
If the gravity weapon fired, the orcs would destroy all the ships they were launching. He did not think they would do so unless desperate. And they weren't. The war was still running their way. The blockade was coming apart, like the rotten wall it was. More and more interceptors closed in. The Herald's batteries could not take them all down. They were fast. Their construction seemed crude, brutal shapes hurtling through the void. They were not agile, but they absorbed more damage than Imperial ships of comparable size. They came at the strike cruiser with the murderous intent of guided meteors. The Herald had left the false calm of the gap for the heart of the storm. Vast engines of destruction warred with machines of shrieking speed. Death lashed out over distances of tens of thousands of kilometers. The strike cruiser became the center of gravity of the conflict. Orc and Imperial ships converged in response to its movements. Leviathans and lightning found a single focus. The space of the battle constricted. Beam weapons and torpedoes slammed into the Herald. Crippled Orc fighters hurled themselves against its shields as they died. In the Oculus, the void became a strobing storm of explosions and energy discharges. The void shields rippled and flashed, red and searing violet. The attack moon was huge. Its circumference surpassed the edges of the Oculus.
"Lord Commander Corland," Adnakiel boxed, "are you ready to launch?"
"We are."
"Opening bay doors."
Adnakiel stared straight ahead at the void and the gaping rage of the target. In the corner of his eye, he saw the multiplying red of damage icons. He ignored them. He felt each shake and tremor of the ship as a personal blow. He stood fast, willing his ship forward. He knew its injuries. Let it know his determination. The jaws were opening again. The interior of the Orc moon filled the center of the Oculus. Adnakiel glared at the hunger of fire and darkness.
"Launch!" he shouted. "Launch!"
One more klaxon added its voice to the cacophony of warnings on the bridge. It was the only sign of the departure of the Thunderhawks until Corland spoke again.
"You have taken us to the threshold, brother," he said. "Now we have crossed it. Strike hard! The Orcs will feel our blow even on Ulanor."
"Bow up!" Adnakiel roared. "Take us over the pole!"
He would make the Orcs pursue the prize of the Herald of Night. He would be their target. He would draw their eyes away from the insignificant ships flying into the moon. "Strike hard," he thought again. "Strike hard."